Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Democrats might not have gotten the landslide they wanted this November, but they did expand the political map in some pretty meaningful ways. Joe Biden became the first Democrat to win Arizona on the presidential level since 1996, and the first to win Georgia since 1992. If 2016 showed that the upper Midwest was in play for Republicans on the presidential level, 2020 has shown that the Sun Belt is in play for Democrats. And both of those developments could mean a wider and more uncertain political map going forward. So in order to better understand how these shifts happened and how durable they are, today we're going to zoom in on Georgia in particular. It was probably the biggest upset win for Democrats, and how Democratic the state is going to be tested again in less than 7 weeks. As listeners probably know, there are two Senate runoff elections there that are going to decide which party controls the U.S. Senate. So here with me to dive deep into Georgia politics is senior politics writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Good to see you, Galen.
Likewise, and also joining us from the road in Georgia, I think driving from Atlanta to Macon right now, is Atlanta Journal-Constitution political reporter Greg Bluestein. Hey, Greg.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for taking the time. I know that Georgia political coverage is hectic these days, so for those of you watching this on YouTube, you will see that Greg is in his car, pulled over, not actually driving, paying attention to the podcast. But yeah, thanks so much for taking the time. Greg, let's start with you. And in order to put 2020 into context, I think we should back up a little bit and talk about what politics have looked like in Georgia over the past couple decades. So how red has the state been historically?
It's a great question. It has been a very solidly Republican state. The last Democrat to win Georgia in a White House race was Bill Clinton back in 1992. Republicans, starting in 2002, started winning, picking off statewide seats and steadily consolidated power in Georgia. The last Democrat to win a statewide office in Georgia was back in 2006. So it has been a steady Republican role here in Georgia that has been kind of steadily also rolling back. If you look at the margins, they're getting tighter and tighter and tighter. Republicans haven't had any easy coast victories really since 2016 when Johnny Isakson easily beat one of his opponents. But 2018, Stacey Abrams showed that Democrats have a path back to flipping Georgia. And as we saw in 2020, that's what happened.
Perry, you recently wrote an article for the website called How Georgia Turned Blue. And so we have this trend, as Greg described, where it's getting redder, essentially, ever since Bill Clinton won it in 1992. Where is the turning point? When did things start to change in Georgia as you see it?
So in 2004, John Kerry got 41% of the vote. And then in 2007, Obama got 47%. So there was a jump there. And then Obama got sort of went from a state where the Democrats were in the low 40s to in the sort of the mid 40s in 2008 and 2012. And the vote in the Atlanta area, both the city of Atlanta, but also more importantly, suburban Atlanta, shifted left a little bit during the, you know, Obama's two elections. So there was a shift there, and basically what's happened is two things. The Atlanta area is growing in size, and so in urban areas tend to vote for Democrats, and then the Atlanta area is getting more Democratic, in part because people are moving there from other places for their jobs, for businesses, in part because it's getting much more racially diverse, and that doesn't mean Black people, it also means Asian and Latino populations are growing there as well. So right now you have where the Atlanta metro area is somewhere between 45 and more than half of the people in Georgia live in that Atlanta metro area. So what really happened in 2018 and then 2020 was that the Atlanta metro area kind of outvoted the rest of the state, which is still pretty conservative.
Yeah, and Perry, one of the things your article pointed out, which is very smart, was that people can see the suburbs and maybe some other cities as a stand-in for white voters, but not in metro Atlanta. Gwinnett County, one of our biggest suburbs, is a majority-minority county. Cobb County, which has been a Republican stronghold for decades, is about to become a majority minority. White voters make up like 51%. So in a few years, that won't be the case. And where I live in DeKalb County is a majority Black county that is also one of the biggest strongholds for Democrats in the state. So I think people, when they look at the suburban shift, they tend to look at, that's just only white voters who are maybe college-educated women who are turning against Trump. And that is partly the case, but it's also because Atlanta is so sprawling There's no natural barriers to development in our city. There's no rivers or mountains, no major rivers or mountains or oceans or anything like that. And so a very, very diverse population has spread out and is starting to change those suburbs. And counties like Cobb and Gwinnett that have been run by Republicans forever are now having majority Democratic countywide offices.
I want to dig a little deeper into that question of which parts of the electorate exactly have shifted in the past 4 or so years. But before we get into that nitty-gritty, can you put into some perspective how much Georgia politics revolve around Atlanta? Is it like if you win the Atlanta area and the suburbs around Atlanta, you win the state? Is it that dominant?
For Democrats, it is. As Perry mentioned, about half the population of the state is focused on Atlanta. We have other kind of mid-sized cities where candidates campaign, Savannah, Columbus, Macon, Augusta. But most of the attention is focused for Democrats on Metro Atlanta. And conversely, for Republicans, and we really saw this in 2018, Republicans kind of ceded Metro Atlanta to Democrats. They didn't campaign much in Metro Atlanta. They still aired millions of dollars worth of ads in Atlanta's TV markets, but they really focused on small town and rural and exurban areas of Georgia rather than Metro Atlanta and its suburbs, because that's where they racked up huge margins. I mean, counties that used to maybe go 60 or 70% to Mitt Romney went 80 and 90% to Brian Kemp and Donald Trump over the last 4 years. And so that's where Republicans are really trying to undercut Democrats' gains in those Metro Atlanta suburban areas.
Just to quantify that, Biden won around 65% of the vote in the metro area of Atlanta, but then outside that, he won about 37% of the vote.
So very lopsided electorates for both Republicans and Democrats geographically. But that also is a significant change from what we've seen historically, right? I mean, I think when people think of the Atlanta suburbs, they think of national political characters like Newt Gingrich, for example. Mm-hmm. So like, what exactly has changed in those suburban areas? And also, I'm curious, where is the dividing line between suburban and exurban? Because it sounds like Republicans are still winning exurban areas. So what exactly is happening in the suburbs, and what has not changed or what has stayed the same in exurban areas?
Yeah, our holy crap moment was 2016, when we all kind of figured Trump would win Georgia easily. And he won by 5 points, so a smaller margin than Mitt Romney or John McCain carried the state. But he still won without really exerting much effort in the state. He never visited. He didn't have much of a campaign operation here. But our holy crap moment was when Gwinnett and Cobb both flipped. Cobb narrowly, Gwinnett by a little bit more, without any of that institutional effort. And that was the start. And then John Ossoff, a few months later, runs for Tom Price's old congressional seat, which had been Republican for more than 2 decades, which Tom Price had easily won by more than 20 points against kind of a stand-in Democratic figure who didn't really campaign, raises $30 million and comes within a whisker of winning that seat. That was a huge wake-up call to the nation, not just about Georgia's political changes, but also the suburban political changes that were happening everywhere. So I think part of it is the suburbs have become increasingly diverse. As we mentioned before, they're not just this homogenous white area that has been traditionally conservative. Another part is the drain of especially white college-educated women who used to vote Republican for maybe fiscal reasons, who were upset by Trump, but also it goes beyond that, also upset at what was happening in the state. The anti-abortion heartbeat bill that passed in Georgia last year really galvanized a lot of women who are pro-abortion rights and who were upset about those changes and flock to the polls. So I think those are two of the changes. And then as you mentioned, in the exurbs, which are basically, we see those as there's 5 or 6 core Metro Atlanta counties that ring the city. And then there's 8 or 9 counties that ring those. Those have been Republican strongholds for a long time. We're talking like Cherokee County, Forsyth County, and very densely populated. Not as densely populated as those inner Atlanta suburbs, but that's where Republicans get some big margins. And Perry highlighted one of them, Forsyth County. That's where David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler held their first joint event just a few days ago. That's how important it is to Republicans. Donald Trump won that county by about 71%, if my math is right, back in 2016. He's lost about 5 points there in 2020. And those 5 points matter when the margins in Georgia are like 13,000 votes.
Yeah, Perry, how are you conceptualizing some of those changes in your reporting?
So the piece we did said, okay, so Biden won because, you know, the Atlanta area was so big and went more left than before. And that was a kind of a gradual trend. And really the Abrams campaign really grew. Hillary did about 45%. Abrams got about 48, 49. And then Biden got 49, 50. So it was a little bit of a gradual growth. And I sort of tried to look at, okay, so the story is Atlanta, but what happened in Atlanta? And I had four theories about it. The first, as Greg referred to, is just anti-Trump sentiment. So because 2016, 2018, 2020, the Atlanta suburbs all got a little more progressive each successive cycle. So I think that does tell you there probably were some voters who moved from Trump. And I think that's probably both people who maybe were Republicans before who shifted, but I think it also might be people who didn't vote before. I assume there is some amount. Like, I think Abrams got around 1.9 million votes in 2018. The person who ran for governor, who's a Democrat in 2014, Jason Carter, got around 1.1 million voters. So there's a big turnout increase. There also is a turnout increase on the GOP side, too. So the Democrats do have a turnout increase. There's a Republican turnout increase, but I think there is evidence that overall there is a mobilization effect going on. The second thing I talked about was even from 16 to 2020, I think Georgia and the Atlanta area is growing so much. I think there is a real transplant effect there where people are moving there who were not there before. Two other things I think are relevant is, like, Abrams has been talking for 10 years. I hate to focus on one person, but Abrams has been saying for 10 years the Democrats should focus less on moving white swing voters and more on people of color in the Atlanta area and younger people. And people of color, again, not just Black people, but also the growing Asian and Latino population. And so in some ways, like, the Abrams strategy of doing that, she spent 2017, 2018 sort of executing it. In 2019, she wrote this memo to the Democrats saying, we can really win Georgia, laid out steps, really pushed for that. Abrams was not the candidate, but in some ways, she's more the candidate than Warnock and Ossoff are. Like, she has really been doing this, and it looks like it worked. And then the final thing is, it looks like Biden did a little bit better than Ossoff or Warnock did in their races. And it might go to the fact that people in the Atlanta area don't like Trump. But I wonder if maybe Biden does appeal to a few voters that Abrams and Ossoff couldn't win.
Yeah, that's a good point, Perry. I want to just expound on two of them. One is that Biden overperformed John Ossoff, one of the two Democratic Senate contenders, by about 100,000 votes. So there's, like, some evidence that there were maybe some swing or crossover Republican votes. But secondly, what you talked about, Stacey Abrams' strategy, and I know this is happening nationally, but both parties in 2018 made the clear decision that it wasn't worth it to go purely after swing voters like Democrats had been doing for years in Georgia. In 2014, that was kind of Jason Carter's strategy when he ran for governor. He ran as an NRA Democrat because he didn't think he could win in the state if he ran as a liberal. Well, Stacey Abrams proved that by embracing liberal ideals and by talking about things that Democrats in Georgia didn't talk about, like gun control, you could make giant gains, and that it was more worth the bang for your dollars to energize core supporters who might not vote in these midterm elections than trying to go after swing voters in the suburbs or something like that, because you're going to get those anyway. And so, and you saw that the same thing with Brian Kemp. He didn't focus on trying to appeal to those swing voters either. He said his campaign was basically a red wall campaign where they quietly went after Trump supporters in 16 who didn't usually vote in midterms either. And then you really saw that in 2020. And you're about to see that in 2021 with these runoffs, because, again, neither of these four candidates are spending much time persuading. They're all motivating their bases to come back out, because they, I think, rightly believe if they can get 95% of their bases back out, they've won this thing by a landslide.
This kind of debate between persuasion and turnout, which is always somewhat of a dumb debate that we have in the political analysis community around elections, because, of course, generally winning elections requires something of both. And sometimes whatever can help persuade voters can also help turn out voters. And so they're not completely disconnected from each other. But I do want to linger on this for a second, because it's been somewhat of a debate in the post-election analysis of Georgia. How much of the change from 2016 to 2020 is based on turnout or even demographic changes, so the Atlanta area becoming more diverse, for example, versus actual vote switching? I know Nate Cohn, a friend of the podcast over at the New York Times Upshot, did an analysis that said essentially 15% of the change from 2016 to 2020 is based on the demographic changes, but that the majority of the change just from 2016 to 2020 is actually vote switchers. The thing that got Biden over the line are people in the Atlanta area who were actually maybe supporting Republicans in 2016 and now supporting Joe Biden. Overall, of course, Biden lost white voters by 40 points in Georgia. So it's not like the white electorate is now supporting Democrats overwhelmingly. But how do you two think about this argument between the turnout or demographic changes and the vote switchers? Who's responsible for turning Georgia blue, as one might put it?
This is kind of a cop-out, but I think it's both. I think there is a blend of both. You certainly had some Republicans who switched over because they couldn't stomach another term of Trump, but they still voted Republican down ticket. And just like you saw many parts of the nation, Republicans did pretty well here down the ballot. They lost another congressional seat in next door Gwinnett County, but that was also the home of the tightest congressional race in the nation just 2 years ago. So I don't think many Republicans thought they were going to hold on to that race. It was an open seat. The incumbent Rob Woodall decided not to run. And then down ticket, Democrats were looking at, I don't know, 10, 11 net gain in the state legislature. And they ended up with about 2 or 3 net gain. And they lost the House Minority Leader, one of the last white rural Democrats. So you saw both those trends happen down the ballot. So I think Georgia is going to be more of a Florida than a Virginia going forward. I think that we're getting used to a very, very thin margins in these races. But I think, too, that Stacey Abrams showed the model, and that Brian Kemp did as well, that it's going to be about voter mobilization. And I know it's a silly debate we always have, but they're not going for the broad-based messages right now. They're appealing directly to their core audiences. And it's like different universes going on. We're seeing all these leaks of Reverend Warnock sermons that the Republicans hope will come back to haunt Warnock. He's barely addressing them. He's focusing on his own base. And really, like, these things will energize both sides.
Well, so one way to think about this might be, I don't totally always understand exactly what the goal of these mobilization versus persuasion pieces are. They're both, but it's fairly likely that the majority, and if not the majority, the plurality of people who voted for Joe Biden in Georgia are Black. So I think this is what we're talking about really here is, did Black people win it for him or did white people win it for him? And my sense is that the Black part was essential to get close, and then the white part was probably necessary to get over the line. So in some ways, both groups mattered. You need a big Black group to win in Georgia, so I don't want to dismiss those people by saying they were already there. The fact they were there is essential to get close in the first place. It's important not to focus too much on the switch between 16 and 20 as opposed to the overall pie of the voters, which in the first place, you needed this big Black group to get close.
Yeah, and there's another part of that too, which is, yes, white voters have been dominant in the Republican side of elections in Georgia, no surprise. But for Democrats here, the magic marker has always been 30%. They've wanted to get 30% of white vote. And they felt like if they can get around there, they've got a really good shot of flipping the state. And they got close to 30%. I mean, there's still a little murkiness because there's a significant amount of voters who don't state their race when they register to vote. So we're not exactly sure. But, you know, the numbers I've seen gets them in the neighborhood of 30%, which if you compare it to 2016, exit polls showed Hillary Clinton at 21% of the white vote. So if you're at an 8 or 9% gain from that, that helps show you why, yes, Black voters are literally the backbone of the Democratic coalition in Georgia. But if you get a nearly double-digit increase from 16 of white voters, that will get you over the finish line.
I want to talk about how durable some of these shifts are and maybe what the runoff elections can tell us. But first,
hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
So let's look ahead to January 5th, when Georgia becomes the center of the American political universe, because its two runoff Senate elections will determine which party controls the Senate. Greg, how competitive is this race thinking about this 6.5 weeks out?
Oh, it's hyper competitive. You know, Republicans have the traditional advantage. They've won every statewide runoff in Georgia history, but we've never had a runoff like this. We've never had a runoff where Senate control hangs in the balance. And I think just as importantly, we were just talking about the base of Democratic voters in Georgia being African Americans. We've never had a runoff with a black candidate at the top of the ticket like we do right now with Reverend Raphael Warnock, who is the pastor of Martin Luther King Jr.'s church in the heart of Atlanta, who is backed by Stacey Abrams. So Democrats hope that with him on the ticket and with John Ossoff, who also has a fervent following and is running to be the first Jewish senator in Georgia history, so he'll bring a different appeal as well. They hope that with those two at the top of the ticket, they can bring out a core of voters who just don't vote in a lot of these runoff races in Georgia history.
Perry, how are you thinking about the ways that the electorate in the runoff election might change between November 3rd and January 5th?
I don't know. I'm sort of leery of the conventional view, which seems to sort of hint that the black vote won't turn out for the Democrat. I think that's a lot of the implication. And so I'm not sure I just don't know. I think that, you know, runoffs historically have had lower turnout overall. And so that probably means a lot of people are not participating. But I think this is going to be a different environment. And so I think we should sort of watch and see. I don't have a lot of strong predictions. Both campaigns are going to spend a lot of money. They're going to be very involved in it. I think the core thing that I think is less the turnout is, like, we had a big turnout election. It looks like there's a sliver of people who will vote for a Perdue, but who won't vote for Trump. We sort of had an election already. I sort of think that Perdue is closer to 50 than Ossoff, and I'll be surprised. I don't think it's a turnout question. I think it's like Georgia may have more Republicans than Democrats unless it's Trump is running.
Yeah, I guess there's also this kind of new piece of the equation, which is Trump's Republican coalition has started to rely so much on rural white voters and non-college educated white voters who may also be low propensity voters and who may not show up in a runoff at the same rate that the Republicans' old coalition in, like, the early aughts in Georgia might have. So I guess that's an open question.
Yeah, I was just saying that's why you're seeing Republicans tiptoeing around Trump even, I think, more so than they are nationally here in Georgia, because they are desperately worried that ticking him off, that conceding that he lost the election will burn him, will jeopardize any sort of his support with his loyal base. Because he came to Georgia the Sunday before the election to Northwest Georgia, in the area of Rome, Georgia, where it's a heavily Republican area, and tens of thousands of people showed up, this little airport. And I don't know what's happening around the country, but it was a reminder to me of how fervent that base is, and a lot of voters who don't usually vote in these lower turnout elections. So David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler are reliant on him, and they can't make the argument that they wish they could make, I think, right now, to those kind of more middle-of-the-road Republican voters. And that argument would be, hey, Democrats are about to have complete control of Washington if we don't stand up right now, if we're not the firewall. And they can't make that argument because they haven't conceded that Trump lost yet.
So being on the ground, does it seem like Loeffler and Perdue are taking the more Trumpist approach to winning an election in Georgia? Because you would think if, as Perry mentioned, there seem to be Republicans who don't like Trump but are okay with Perdue, that part of putting together a winning coalition is appealing to those suburbanites in the Atlanta area who don't really like the Trump style of politics. But are they playing the Trump style of politics, or are they also trying to play the Chamber of Commerce style politics that were Georgia Republican politics for decades?
So far, Trump type of politics. So far, it's been Democrats will mount to the road to socialism. It's China. And it's echoing Trump's rhetoric about the false narrative that the election was stolen. They came out really early, just a few days ago, and basically appeased President Trump by calling for the Secretary of State of Georgia, who's the top elections official and who's also a Republican, to resign because of what they saw as faulty oversight of the system. They didn't bring any evidence of widespread fraud. And only on background did one of the campaigns bring us reasons why he should resign. And basically, it was exactly the same reasons that Stacey Abrams had criticized Republicans for, including Brian Kemp when he was the Secretary of State, for, like, long lines, technical glitches at the polls, all these issues that you didn't hear Republicans complain about not only 2 years ago, but also after our really bad meltdown in the June primary, where we had people waiting in lines for 8-9 hours at the polls because of poorly trained poll workers and all sorts of glitches at the system. So I just found it very, I don't know what the best word is, hypocritical, whatever it might be, that Republicans were just choosing right now to bring up the same issues that Democrats had been raising for years.
So that's the kind of campaign that Loeffler and Perdue are running. Perry, what kind of campaign are Ossoff and Warnock running?
So Ossoff has been doing a little bit of the sort of, I'm not for the Green New Deal, I'm not for Medicare for all, I'm not for defund the police. Warnock doing some of that too. So, I mean, they're running in Georgia, they seem to know that. So I think they are going to tiptoe into the centrist zone a little bit and try to figure that out while also mobilizing the base too. You know, there's talk that Biden might come down there. I'll be curious if that happens. Also Obama. I see the Republicans as running more of a sort of a base campaign. And even Abrams, I felt like, ran a little bit more of a swing. It was not Jason Carter, but I do think the Democrats are trying to see the math the way I do, which is that they need to do more persuasion than the Republicans do.
Yeah, and they've got to rebut a lot of these allegations too. I mean, it's really interesting because three of these four candidates have been defined publicly. Ossoff started running in 2017. He got a ton of attention. Everyone in Metro Atlanta seems to have seen one of his commercials, I'm sure, way back when $60 million was spent on that race. Already, just for this runoff, $130 million plus has been spent or reserved in TV airtime. So it's ridiculous, right? A torrent of money. David Perdue has been in office for 6 years. Kelly Loeffler has had a year or so of campaigning against Doug Collins. So they're all pretty well defined. Raphael Warnock had the field to himself. There was very few attacks on him from either of the Republicans running because they were more focused. Doug Collins and Kelly Loeffler were just battering each other. And so he kind of had the field to himself. And right now he is just getting tarred and bruised every day by different leaks of his past sermons or his past stances or a 2002 arrest. And he has a lot less time to answer those charges than if they had come out in August or April or whenever. So I think that's one of the more interesting dynamics of this race. And as we've mentioned, they're all running as a package deal. I mean, Ossoff winning and Warnock losing wouldn't help Democrats at all. That means the Republicans still control the Senate. So Loeffler and Perdue are running at joint events. They barely talk to each other in public, at least, during the first phase of this race because it was so contentious on the Republican side. Now they're showing up at events. The event I'm driving down to shortly will be a joint event they're having. And Warnock and Ossoff are running jointly as well. So that means any attack on Warnock's past sermons, whatever they might be, they could also hurt Ossoff, just like any attack on, let's say, David Perdue's stock transactions could drag down Loeffler.
Wrapping up here and going back to our 30,000-foot view, how durable are the political changes that we've seen in Georgia, and how much will these Senate runoffs tell us about their durability?
So basically what happened in the Trump era with Abrams and then with Biden and Ossoff was that Democrats have been capped for like around 45, 46 in most Georgia races statewide for a while, with Abrams 49, Ossoff 49, Warnock and the other Democrats 49, Biden basically almost 50. So looking at it from my point of view, if Ossoff only gets 47, then I might think that, hey, maybe this was all a bit of a anti-Trump thing as opposed to a bigger shift. Because I think part of what you're watching for is these races in Georgia were all really close and the Democrats won one when they could run on the anti-Trump thing. This runoff, I mean, we don't know if Trump will ever concede, but these runoffs will happen in an environment in which most voters, I assume, will be thinking Trump is no longer president. My vote is not sticking into Trump anymore. It's like a different process. So if Ossoff and Warnock still get in the 48-49 zone, that'll tell me that Georgia is a very close state that probably leans Republican a little bit. If they're in the 45-46 zone, that'll tell me, oh, this was like an anti-Trump thing and the Democrats are going to still have trouble in a race that's, you know, really hard in this state otherwise without Trump.
I agree. It'll be hard to read too much into these returns, but I expect higher turnout than we've ever had in a runoff in Georgia history, which is not a huge prediction to make. Also, if you look at the last, I mean, in 18, and this is an imperfect example, but still, in 18, we had a razor-thin margin between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp. And a few weeks later, we had runoffs for Secretary of State and a Public Service Commission seat where Republicans kind of easily, I mean, they won by 4 or 5 points, so it wasn't a blowout. But you saw some of the same dynamics that Republicans had always used to win in Georgia kind of set in. Democrats still won the suburbs, but by a lesser margin. It tended to be an older and whiter electorate, which helped Republicans. And I can tell you, Republicans here in every event I've been to are energized, you know, and it's really interesting being at these rallies because Marco Rubio had a rally in Cobb County, which Democrats have flipped, but is still a super important county for Republicans in Georgia because it's such a populous county. And he didn't mention Donald Trump's name once the entire event. But what he did say was, this is the showdown of all showdowns. This is as important as ever for Republicans to show up. And there is, you know, 300 mostly unmasked people in this room who are rallied and ready to go and fired up. And I expect the same thing when I go down to Middle Georgia, Perry, Georgia, for this event in a few hours. There's going to be just a lot of energy on the ground. And Democrats have the same thing. Democrats have a lot of energy, too. So I think this will be looked at as a lot of ways, right? A litmus test on President-elect Biden's administration, whether or not there's Democrats can show up to the polls if Trump isn't on the ballot, and whether or not Republicans can show up to the polls if Trump isn't on the ballot. And I think it'll be looked at in that narrative. But remember, it's not your typical Georgia election whatsoever.
All right. Well, thank you so much to both of you for clarifying the trends in Georgia and what to expect from this runoff election. So thanks, Perry. And thank you, Greg.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Galen. Thanks, Greg.
Greg Bluestein is a political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. Claire Bidigary-Curtis is on audio editing. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.